All right, welcome everyone once again to yet another episode of The Middle Chamber, and we are so glad to welcome back our guest from last week. One of the guests that we had was Professor James Fetzer from several places where you should check out. One of them is assassinationscience.com. The other one's assassinationsresearch.com. But he's also the host of his own podcast, The Real Deal with Jim Fetzer, over at radiofetzer.blogspot.com. And he is just a plethora of knowledge, so relevant and contemporary to what is going on socially here in America, internationally. And his, of course, his forte obviously is conspiracy assassinations and the people involved and all the facts and figures. And so we really wanted to have him come back on to just share some of the knowledge that he has gathered from decades of research, all at the highest level of inquiry, which is really, as we know, is an important fact when we're looking at all the information out there. We have to have a standard, a level of inquiry that we can use to discern the information we're reviewing and processing. It is so easy to get caught up and taken down rabbit holes of misinformation and disinformation and to get stuck with really wrong-headed thinking about certain ideas that limit the ability of the individual to transcend the mind control and the propaganda out there. And so, you know, Mater X and I, who's all as always by my side.
Hello, everyone.
We are here to just bring this information to you and bring the guests on, like our good friend, Professor Fetzer, who is going to talk to us about all kinds of subjects. Of course, we invited him to come back to talk about more about 9/11 and JFK because it's so relevant to America, but also to get into some really current events, as like what's transpiring in Ferguson, Missouri, and how that's connected to so many other events in a chain of causality and an evidentiary route that we can look at to explore and to identify and to understand and explain what's going on in our world today. And, you know, Mater X and I, we've always been troublemakers because we ask difficult questions and uncomfortable questions about reality, and which disrupts the status quo and the ruling paradigm. And along with numerous things that I am reviewing currently right now, I'm reviewing Peter Lavenda's three-volume set. It's called Sinister Forces, a grimoire of American political witchcraft. And in this work, it's an amazing, you know, I don't always agree with everything that any writer says. And there's, of course, everybody has their own specialized field of knowledge. And some of the stuff he's talking about Masonry, I might take exception to some factoids or conclusions he makes, which I'm sure everyone could understand when you're dealing with your specialities. But in the end, this book is really an interesting and intriguing analysis. And he discusses the link between the word royalty and reality, between royal and real, like in the Latin "real" for royal. And what is real? And what is real is the real estate, the royal kingdom of ideas and beliefs. What is outside of that royal kingdom of ideas is outside of reality. So it's sort of like a medieval approach to the idea, the etymology of the language. When people start to question things outside of reality, they challenge the royal view, the divinely sanctioned view, the government's ruling forces view of reality. And Robert Anton Wilson spoke of the concept of consensus reality. Reality is, in fact, a shapeshifter, dependent as much on political decisions as on scientific observation. There is, in fact, everyone knows, and maybe you don't know it, there is a social contract which is imposed from the top down. It's a general agreement that we all come to as to what constitutes reality. It's that web of communication that I've referred to before. And we asked the question, last week we asked the question for our podcast, Quid est veritas? What is truth? With the clever, I might say, double entendre of a medieval image of Pilate and Christ in the famous hand-washing scene from the Gospels. But, you know, that was just a subtle little, you know, thing I put in there. But we must consider the limits of inquiry as our, this is to coin a phrase from our returning special guest, Professor Fetzer. He made that statement in the last show about the limits of inquiry. And I wanted to explore that further with him, the ideas of the limits of inquiry and what comes of this. And before welcoming him back into the Middle Chamber, I just want to invite you to go to all the usual spots to make contact with us online. I'm not even going to mention them because I mention them every week and everybody knows what they are. But just look up the Middle Chamber, Freighter X, Mater X, you'll find where we are. But I just wanted to say that I wanted to reiterate our mission statement, which is, whether by design or default, we are here to afflict the comfortable and to comfort the afflicted. And by this definition, we are here to ask the difficult questions, ladies and gentlemen, and we're here to be open to difficult questions and difficult answers. We cannot please everyone all the time with this tact, of course. That's what we know. We receive messages regularly, every day, especially this past week, with the vast majority of which were basically in support of our attempts to explore alternative and often uncomfortable views and conclusions. And like, you know, Lavenda in this book that I'm reading, he's setting out to identify and explain the ideas of sinister forces at work and at the root of America's political system, which, you know, with the evidence we have to work with, there's quite a possibility that there's something to all that, really. But he asks the question, you know, himself in the beginning of the second volume, why bother? Why concern ourselves with such an arcane task? You know, people have been asking this of me my whole life. Why bother with the arcane tasks you've set before you? And, you know, here's why. We need to bother. We need to look behind the curtains. You know, people, as Lavenda puts it himself in a quote from his book, even one aspect of it here is, modern science in the 21st century is on the verge of a major breakthrough in the physics of consciousness. We barely understand consciousness and the forces that are there within. We barely understand it. And you know what, people? The sorcerers of our world today, the politicians, the priests, and the generals, they've used their knowledge of human consciousness to commit murder and other outrages and atrocities, genocide, and they cover it all up. And they employ occult and esoteric means and methods whenever it is expedient. And that's why it's important to look at these designs and these systems, if for nothing else, to identify the falsehoods and to move beyond them towards the truth. And with that, I want to welcome our extra special guest here in the middle chamber, Professor James H. Fesser. Thank you for joining us today. Jim, how are you?
Oh, real pleasure to be back, Fratter and Matter and your cat. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, everyone, you'll hear in the background, Dusty, our little girl, she's growing up into woman cathood, or however you'd say it, female cathood. Okay. Well, anyways, Jim, you know, setting up that ball there for you to knock it out of the park, really.
Well, you've just talked about a wide range of issues. In particular, the question about the limits of inquiry had to do with academic communities and whether there should be any impositions, political, moral, or otherwise, on the subjects that are pursued by faculty and students. I participated in an academic freedom conference at the University of Illinois just a few months ago, which has been published online under the heading Academic Freedom, Are There Limits to Inquiry? JFK, 9/11, and the Holocaust, because we use those three as our examples. It seems to me obvious that JFK, 9/11, and especially the Holocaust, are not receiving their due consideration, considering their pivotal role in history, where the Holocaust in particular, the official narrative, has been used to play on a Western sense of guilt in order to for Israel to derive immense benefits and preferential treatment, insofar as my own research suggests that the major components of the official narrative, 6 million having died, the use of gas chambers in Zyklon B, appear to be unsustainable. That where the records of the International Committee of the Red Cross, which were visiting all of these camps and keeping very scrupulous, meticulous notes, might warrant that some 271,000, I'm talking about gypsies as well as Jews and the mentally and physically infirm, died in those camps. Actually, they turn out to be labor camps rather than extermination centers. You can't get work out of dead people, so it was in the interests of the Third Reich that they preserve them alive and well. They were located near major munitions factories and the like, and appeared that the staggering number who died in the end from starvation and so forth, all those dead bodies we saw in those mass pits, were because of the Allied bombing of German cities, which interdicted railroad lines and made it impossible to resupply the camps. We have an enormous amount of evidence that substantiates this very revisionist review of history, where I highly recommend an article that can be found online by Robert Forreson entitled Against Revisionism, Hollywoodism, which gives an overview of the situation at the end of the war, where the Allies used the Nuremberg Tribunal to basically attribute the atrocities that, for which they were responsible, the mass starvation of the inmates, onto Hitler and his staff, even though during the tribunal they expressed astonishment that there had been any deliberate plan to exterminate the Jews because they were all unaware of it. What's like Robert McNamara being told that there was a plan to reinvade Cuba in a book by Tom Hartman and another fellow. He never heard of it. Well, that's because there was no such plan, and it's because Hitler wasn't, in fact, seeking to exterminate the Jews. But you have to go into this in some depth to realize that even the number of 6 million appears to have theological or religious roots, not empirical or historical ones. There were articles, some 257 citations of 6 million Jews from 1890 right up to the end of the war before the Nuremberg tribunals. In my presentation during the Academic Freedom Conference, I reviewed a sampler of them and discussed all of these issues. Even if you were to round up the International Committee of the Red Cross number to 600,000, that's only 10% of the alleged number that has been claimed. But it all appears to be a gross exaggeration, and it's a very distressing the effect it has had politically to create, you know, as though it were a preferred nationality, a preferred race of citizens because of these alleged atrocities, when it appears, based upon my research, that it's by and large a myth, but it's been politically extremely expedient and very beneficial for Israeli politicians to promote the interests of Israel, even at the expense of the rest of the nations of the world. It's like all the donations to the families of the victims of Sandy Hook, where we have determined that no children actually died there. We have a mountain of evidence. Would you believe the latest revelation? This is over and beyond the dash cam videos that shows that there were no teachers leading students in an evacuation at the places and times specified by the police, that the iconic photograph of a policewoman leading about a dozen students out was staged. They even repositioned the order of the students to get the best shot. We've been able to prove that. It doesn't even appear to have been taken the day of the alleged shooting, when the temperature was 28 degrees and there was frost on the ground, but much earlier in the year, possibly October, where the kids aren't wearing cold weather gear and there's no frost visible. We know that the official report from Stephen Sadensky, who was a Danbury State's attorney, fails to create a causal nexus connecting the alleged shooter, Adam Lanza, with the death of his mother or the alleged victims in the school. The as it acknowledges, the .22 rifle he's supposed to have shot his mother using had no fingerprints, and the only DNA on a shell casing was tracked back to an ex-convict, which is, to my knowledge, never been pursued. Even more astonishing, although they had some 150 bullet fragments in the school, purportedly, they were unable to connect any of them to the alleged weapon, the AR-15 Bushmaster he was alleged to have used, which means there's no case against Adam Lanza. And insofar as that report does not include the names, the ages, or the sex of any of the children who are supposed to have died, we have this among other forms of evidence. There's a fellow by the name of Lenny Posner who has been very vicious in attacking those of us who are trying to get at the truth about Sandy Hook. He has released what he claims is a death certificate for his son Noah, which turns out to be a fabrication. It's a fake death certificate. And would you believe, this is a real topper, just today I learned that Noah is actually appearing on billboards to promote a water park in Ontario, Canada. Noah is alive and well, so there we have a striking case of one of the alleged child victims who turns out to be, you know, posing very appropriately in advertising in Ontario, Canada. I mean, it is dumbfounding the extent to which this hoax has been used to terrorize the American people. In fact, this is a very striking illustration of the American government fabricating an event that's intended to strike fear into the hearts and minds of the American people, especially mothers and children, in order to make us amenable to manipulation to promote their political agenda, which in this case has to do with the subversion of our rights under the Second Amendment and the introduction of mental health criteria that can be used to subvert due process and deprive Americans of life, liberty, and property without due process.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that gun control, reactionary. That was the rhetoric that came out in the wake of that event at Sandy Hook, and of course, to shift back to the talk of the World War II, the reason why it's all relevant, the reason why you can go right from talking about the Third Reich and what were the conclusions of Nuremberg to Sandy Hook is because, as you pointed out, it's an exact same thing. It's the government using events, whether contrived or otherwise, except in Sandy Hook, as you pointed out, the big divergence is that they actually created the entire event. But the bottom line is they're using information, news information, to manipulate the public of America, to bring them into the fold and to get them to go along with the consensus reality.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And when you control the press, you know, and you can get endless iterations of your story, no matter how fabricated, as we found in the case of Sandy Hook, completely or almost completely uncritical acceptance, although the day of the shooting, we did have reports about only handguns having been found with a body, that the Bushmaster wasn't found with a body. That's very striking. And other reports that Adam Lanza might not even exist. I mean, apart from those really quite striking incidents of reporting that appears to have been solid and well done, the national media has basically swooned in the face of the proposition that this young man entered this school and murdered 20 children after having shot his mother and then six more adults and before taking his own life. The whole thing is really such a sham. It's an embarrassment, but we've been sold it on every level, including local, state, and federal, where Barack Obama and Eric Holder appear to have been principals in orchestrating this event to promote their aggressive anti-gun control, their anti-gun agenda.
And of course, you know, the burden of proof shifts. Normally in deductive reasoning, you know, your burden of proof remains on the evidence. But with our pop culture minded consensual reality, what happens is when it's stated in the media, once it goes out over the airs, that's what people believe. And what they hear in the media is what they believe with the absence of evidence. And even when you go back and look, like, for example, going back to the myths that surrounded Hitler, according to research we've done, the diaries of Dr. Morell, who was Hitler's personal physician, show that, as a matter of fact, Hitler had no STDs. He had no sexually transmitted diseases, and that he actually had been diagnosed with possibly arterial sclerosis in 1941 with the rapid acceleration of the German progress matching that, which means that maybe the decisions he was making were of a man who knew his time was short, and which is contrary to a lot of what we've found in the, you know. And then you combine that with, there's a lot of, I don't know if you're familiar with David Irving's work. I think you mentioned that you knew who he was, but you hadn't really reviewed his research. Is that correct? That was David Irving's work. He's done some, he wrote a book about the...
I'm looking forward to interviewing David Irvine. He's been one of the most successful revisionist historians of our time. And of course, he suffered greatly and been pilloried because of it.
Right. And the research that, I mean, he's put out a cash reward to anyone to produce one single wartime document that explicitly states that there was any extermination of Jews, anything that Hitler made it clear that Hitler was even aware of some of the atrocities that are being claimed to have been committed in the camps, which I think it's never been. He's never paid out that money. No one has ever produced a document of wartime. He actually has come across documents that were false. He used ink aging tests to determine the age of documents, because it turns out ink contains iron, which oxidizes at a certain rate that can be measured. Therefore, you can tell how old ink is on documents. And some documents that were brought forward supposedly stating this were, in fact, forgeries. So, I mean, and this is the kind of thing that happens with...
Well, even the diary of Anne Frank apparently is a fraud. It's, you know, I mean, there's so much going on here.
And there's more versions of Mein Kampf, supposedly, than one. Also, there was supposedly Hitler's second book published in the 50s by a German publishing house, a man named Gerhard Weinberg. Are you familiar with that?
No, but go ahead.
Well, it's just an interesting aside that very few people seem to be familiar with this volume, yet it was published in the 50s and made available, you know, as an underground publication in America. And it's just, I'd like to get my hands on this book, actually, to just get some sort of contrast to it. But I know that within Mein Kampf, it's interesting that in one of the versions of Mein Kampf talks about if the Jewish people should manage to create their own country, that they would commit crimes in their home countries until it became, this is paraphrasing, of course, until they had to flee, and then they would flee to their new land and avoid extradition. I'm paraphrasing, but that was from a long quote in Mein Kampf, which is remarkable considering moving towards, for example, what's happened in Gaza, you know, what the Israeli government and the Zionist policies have seemed to do in many places but outside of Israel. And then oftentimes individuals end up fleeing to Israel to avoid extradition. Isn't that correct, Jim?
Yes, yes, it is. Yes, it is. In fact, I'm becoming persuaded now that I need to read Mein Kampf. Believe it or not, I've in the past suggested that, as in the case of the Warren Report, which claims that, you know, this sole demented gunman got off three lucky shots to kill the President of the United States, which is indefensible on all kinds of grounds, that you know, it's not necessary to pour through the Warren Commission report to see how they artificially constructed their case. Actually, the report itself gives you a summary outline in the beginning, and I have published, you know, on the main claims made by the Warren Report and shown how we have disproven each and every one of them. In the case of Mein Kampf, you presume he's expounding, you know, military aggression, territorial conquest, and systematic genocide. That's the impression we're given, but I'm willing to believe that, in fact, reading the text is going to reveal that that is, in fact, not the case.
Well, that's another thing, Jim, that you mentioned, which I think is also remarkable, is that there are a lot of different speeches that are circulating right now of Hitler's. And, you know, you got to wonder, I got to be honest, I'm still trying to, like, I know I brought up last time about certainty and how you made the distinction, which I think was a good correction of the idea of you can only find probable what is most probable and not what is most certain. And so, you know, when we're thinking in terms of the probability, I gotta be honest, I suspect the probability would be that we would get an improper translation of the speeches that are given to us in foreign languages when it's politically expedient,
well,
right or wrong.
Well, there's an historic example with the then president of Iran giving a speech in which he said in Persian that about the regime in Israel that it too will pass with time, but where the translators have said that Israel must be wiped off the map. I mean, notice the complete difference in talking about the equivalent of a regime change versus national destruction. But that plays again into the hands of the Israeli Zionists who want to demonize Iran and claim that it's some kind of threat to their existence, which is far, far, far from the case. Iran, in fact, is a peace-loving nation, hasn't invaded any other nation for over 300 years, has disavowed the development of nuclear weapons, has signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, has allowed inspectors. Israel, by contrast, has a vast stockpile of undeclared nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, has not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, will not allow inspectors. There is a problem of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, but it has nothing to do with Iran and everything to do with Israel.
Yeah, actually, Jim, I often mention this to friends I'm talking to about Iran with, and for for me, it's kind of crazy because we have a map, like a National Geographic map, that is a time-lapsed photograph of the Earth at night, and it shows lights in all of the metropolitan areas. And there's bright lights everywhere, and even in the semi-rural and suburban type areas across the world, and it's got lights here and there scattered around, you know, so you know there's life. And you go and you look in the Middle East, And there's lights in Iraq. There's lights all over Saudi Arabia. There's lights in India and in the surrounding areas in the, northern Asia areas. But you go to look at Iran, and the only light you're actually really seeing in this photograph is coming from where I would say Tehran is. And the rest of the nation is in pretty much darkness. And so to me, it's never been a question of them developing nuclear power for the sake of weaponry, but to join the 21st century.
Yes. They have an ambitious program to develop the peaceful use of nuclear energy. And because they can undercut the American nuclear energy industry in providing fuel rods to, for power plants for other countries, the American nuclear energy industry has a keen interest in seeing that be cut, which I think is a part of the motivation behind, the exaggerated claims about Iran as representing a nuclear threat. It's all quite preposterous. It goes so far as that Benjamin Netanyahu has proposed these strikes on the nuclear facilities in Iran, where there's no evidence whatsoever that they're developing nuclear weapons, but where such attacks have been estimated to bring about the deaths of 1 million Iranians outright. And then as the cloud of contamination sweeps across Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, another 35 million premature deaths, put it together, that's 36 million, six times the alleged claim for the number of Jews who died during the Holocaust. I mean, he's willing to do that on the basis of no proof or evidence whatsoever, all for political purposes. It's about as despicable as it gets.
And it makes me think, actually, of the fact that, I don't want to draw any fire, but if we're going to talk about 6 million Jews dying in World War II at the hands of Hitler, why aren't we talking about the 20 plus million people that died at the hands of Stalin? And where are the funds, and where are the Remember the Russians deaths, monuments and everything like that? And where is the outrage?
Yeah, or the 14 to 16 Native Americans who were here in North America before the settlers arrived and started wiping them out. Or the millions of Vietnamese we slaughtered in Vietnam. We lost 50,000, but they lost over 2 million. You're making very appropriate points, Mater.
I don't know. It just seems imbalanced to me, like our attentions are being diverted for some
for political
reason.
Purposes. It's
right,
all deliberate. Exactly. Yes.
Well, it's the shaping of that consensus of what we're going to believe is real. I mean, I invite all the listeners to look up some facts on the casualty rates of all the nations in World War II. You'll be surprised at the numbers. I was very surprised, Jim, at the numbers of deaths of the countries that were involved in World War II. For example, I was surprised that less than 500,000 U.S. and English, each individually, less than 500,000 died, whereas tens of millions of other nations that you wouldn't even think, like how about Indochina? There was millions of people who died there.
Yeah.
How about in China? Millions of people died. The Philippines, millions of people died. How is that we never think about all the other nations? And like Maderek said, in Russia, over 20 million died during World War II.
Yes, absolutely right.
Often killed by Stalin's regime.
Yeah, his
own. Not warfare with the Germans,
our ally.
Genocide
our ally
against
Stalin,
his own people.
Yeah. Right. It's just a remarkable point, and it's the way that we let the shells fall from our eyes, right?
It's called marketing and packaging. We're sold quite a bill of goods about the Holocaust to benefit Israel because it has so many allies in the press and in Hollywood. These others, the millions and millions of dead, like the Indians, for example, or the Vietnamese, or the victims of the collectivization of the farms in Russia and so forth, we don't hear from them. They have no representatives among the press or in Hollywood, sad to
say.
That's it right there, Jim. That's the point I would like to bring right now to this conversation. That's why we're talking about this. And if that's the case with that one isolated issue, how many other issues are we being misinformed about, ladies and gentlemen? How many other issues are we being bald-faced lied to about?
And why are we so afraid? So afraid to just look at these things.
Well, but fear comes from the fact that once you realize what the truth is, you're responsible now to act. How are you going to act with the knowledge of truth? Right, Jim?
That's true.
Yes.
And you know, that's
why many people don't want to know. You know, they don't want to know more about 9/11. They're fearful that if they actually knew mm-hmm. the truth, they might have a sense of obligation and feel, you know, incapable of doing anything, which makes them feel badly about themselves for what they perceive as their own moral weakness. But the fact of the matter is, even if you're not in the position to do anything about it, you need to know the truth. I mean, unless you actually understand what is the truth, you can't take appropriate actions, whatever they might be. If your actions are based on falsehoods, then they're going to be inappropriately guided no matter what you do. So, I mean, we have a high obligation, even in relation to our own conduct, to determine the nature of the true about matters that affect us in our own behavior.
Yeah, you know, this is a great segue, because when we think about the 60s, ladies and gentlemen, everyone thinks about the civil rights movements and we think about the motivating factors. And I've often wondered to myself, well, why? Why was it such a motivating factor in the 60s for people to be so vehemently anti-war? What we don't remember is there was a draft going on in the 60s, in the 70s. You had no choice. Your child drafted, if you can't buy his way out or whatever else, he's going to war. And that was bringing it right to the dinner table, right to the home fire. Nowadays, we're not drafting people, so we never even think about it nowadays. But back then, like right now, we're living in the town of Lawrence, Kansas, which is, you know, probably several hundred miles away from Ferguson, Missouri, mm-hmm. where they're currently having such problems. And, you know, the media is busily shaping and packaging it as they will. But let me tell you something. Almost 44 years ago, ladies and gentlemen, right here in Lawrence, Kansas, it was like Ferguson. There was actually two shootings of youths, two freshman college students, one of them a lifelong resident of Lawrence who was a black student, and one of them who was from out of town who was a white student, and they were both involved in civil rights and anti-war and in equal rights for blacks, for gays, and for women in Lawrence, Kansas, and they were shot dead in the streets by the cops. Shot dead in the streets, and it was two separate occasions. One was shot dead in the streets, and then 4 days later, the students actually gathered to protest that shooting, and they shot into the crowd, and another student was killed there. That's where the white student was killed. And it is just so amazing, because we've lived in Lawrence for almost 10 years, and I have never heard of this. I have never even, you know, the kids today in Lawrence at the high school or at the college, and by the way, the high school marched out too. The high school of Lawrence, Kansas, which seems impossible to me to imagine that happening today. What would happen if all the black students in Lawrence High decided to protest because, well, the reason they were protesting then, because they didn't have any black cheerleaders, they didn't have a black homecoming queen, and they didn't have a black teacher teaching the kids. This is, by the way, over 100 years after Lawrence was burned to the ground by pro-slavery Quantrill's raiders, because Lawrence was supposedly an abolitionist town and state, Kansas. So they killed over a couple hundred people, men, women, children. Yeah, several times, by the way, burned this place to the ground for abolition, for freedom, right? And now, then 100 years later, the black high school students are walking out because they're not being represented. Jim Crow laws are in full effect in this abolitionist town. Your thoughts on this, Jim?
Well, I think it's fascinating. I mean, American history has so many nooks and crannies, and what you're bringing out is a really particularly fascinating episode, both cases, with the history of Lawrence and the more recent shooting. Ferguson is quite striking on multiple grounds, not only because the community is largely black and the police force almost entirely white, but because of the militarization of the local police, which has taken place all over the country. The Homeland Security has created what they call fusion centers that merge federal, state, and local anti-terrorist activity. The fusion centers have been strikingly unable to discover any domestic terrorism. We have a report from a subcommittee of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security that was released on 3 October 2012. Based upon its review of 680 Fusion Center reports gathered during 2009-2010 from all over the country. And would you believe in that 680 reports? And remember, these Fusion Centers are out to find terrorist activity, if there is any. they could find none, not a single report of domestic terrorist activity, nor any indication anything they had done had ever interfered with or stopped an attempted terrorist action, which is a very reasonable ground statistically to infer that domestic terrorism in the United States is virtually non-existent, which is why they have to fabricate or contrive all these other incidents like Sandy Hook or the Boston bombing, the granddaddy of which, of course, is 9/11. But to stay on Ferguson for the time being, the fact is that that massive response in force with this military equipment created a frightening scenario for the American people. Instead of seeing a police force that was there to serve and protect, a friendly community buffer as a defense against crime and mischief, you found a massive force allied against the people that was treating them as the enemy. We also know that the events of Ferguson have been grossly exaggerated by many media. Lawrence O'Donnell on his television program 10 days ago or so had three witnesses to what had transpired. One of them described something going on in the vehicle as an altercation. Another said there was some wrestling. A third said that there was some punching going on. But it's very clear that Michael Brown fled the scene, that the officer got out of the vehicle, and the reports of one flurry of six shots and then another of four. At least one of the shots appears to have been a warning shot that caused Michael Brown to turn around with his hands in the air, and he was hit no less than four times in the arm and twice in the head, once at the very top of the head, suggesting to me he was lying on the ground or well kneeling over before that shot took place, presumably the round that killed him, and the other four fired at his friend with whom he'd been walking at the time before they were stopped for walking in the street. I mean, it's supposed to be the case that you can jaywalk without being shot to death by the local police, but that's not the case in Ferguson, Missouri.
That's really interesting, Jim. And one thing that I noticed in the bit that we've been reading about Lawrence's history is the young man who, the first one who was shot, the young black student, he had been, quote, a known activist in the local Black Panther Association. And so the article that we read about this said that the police had been watching his movements. And so that kind of makes me wonder if this thing that happened in Ferguson might have been of a similar nature, in the sense that was Michael Brown involved in some kind of other activities? I mean, the knee-jerk reaction from the from many people might be that he might have been involved in gang activity, but maybe he wasn't. What if he was like this other student in 1970? Maybe he was involved in something that was politically motivated, that might have been getting under the skin of the local law enforcement.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me at all, Mater. That's a very plausible scenario. So, you know, presumably as we dig deeper and deeper, we'll find whether or not that is the case. But I just say it could very well be.
Jim, you were just receiving your PhD in 1970, correct?
Yes.
So where were you? Were you up north in Madison or were you somewhere else?
No, I earned my PhD at Indiana University in the history and philosophy of science. I resigned my commission as a Marine Corps officer. I'd been a captain at the time to enter graduate school in 1966 on the campus in Bloomington, Indiana. And I earned my master's the first 2 years, did my third year at Columbia, and used that as my outside minor in philosophy for my degree in the history and philosophy of science.
So what was the climate in the Indiana campus and the other subsequent campuses that you were on, Jim?
More interesting is Columbia, because I was there at Columbia from 68 to 69. And this is when SDS was trying to shut down the campus. I was there. I got drawn into an organization called Students for Columbia University, which I now believe was an FBI operation. The fellow who was actually more or less organizing it, I realize in retrospect, did not appear to be a student, and I rather suspect he was an FBI agent. But at the time, SDS, in trying to shut down the campus, was standing between me and my PhD, so I took a dim view of that. And I recall being out in the, you know, they had raided an office on campus, and I was in the center of a campus in front of a Butler Library. There's a big square there with a megaphone announcing how they had attacked the Education Placement Center by mistake and thrown typewriters out the window when they thought they were going after some suitable target, providing, you know, support for the military industrial effort. And a group of them came to assault me, and several of my friends actually stood up in my defense. And would you believe, at the end of the year, when CBS ran its montage of the events, there I was right in the middle of a scramble at Columbia University.
That was your first 5 minutes of fame, eh, Jim?
Well, it was like my first involvement in politics. You know, I mean, I would not get seriously involved, for example, about 9/11 until 15 April 2008, when I gave a speech, which I consider my first truly political speech, at a Ron Paul Freedom Rally on the grass outside the Capitol of the United States, where I was explaining that the events of 9/11 appeared to have been brought to us by the neocons in the Department of Defense, and how it's how I was enumerating how many of them are joint U.S.-Israeli citizens, and how inappropriate it is to have anyone in a decision-making or policy-shaping position that it may have an allegiance to another nation that outweighs their allegiance to this nation. So I was calling for their removal from office and the implementation of policies that would not allow joint citizens to hold such positions. Of course, it wasn't going to happen. It hasn't happened yet. And the nefarious influence of these dual citizens continues to this very day. But that was, in fact, my very first political speech, which you can find online at America First Books under the title 9/11 and the Neocon Agenda. I published it originally on Op-Ed News, but the editor of Op-Ed News, where I'd published 40 articles on Op-Ed News, Rob Call, took a dim view when I started publishing about Israeli involvement in 9/11. He subsequently made it impossible for me to post any more. Then he deleted my archive. I mean, he took out all 40 of my articles, which is about as disgusting as it gets. Anyone who is an intellectual who lives, you know, a life involving publishing and so forth, realize that to actually delete a massive body of work, I'm telling you, 40 articles is about as low as it gets. I published about this in an article on Veterans Today, Rob Call, K-A-L-L, the petty tyrant of Op-Ed News. And would you believe, after I published that, I had a half a dozen or more other authors confiding in me by email that they'd been subjected to the same abusive treatment.
Wow. Yeah, you know, that's a side point that is very remarkable, and we want to explore that more one day, is all the pariah and the pilot fish that feed upon researchers, writers, people in the areas of media that get fed upon by supposed producers, publishers, and, you know, people who just steal people's work, undermine their work, sabotage their work. It's unbelievable, Jimmy. I'm not surprised, though, that happened.
Well, it's an obscenity, and it's just a manifestation of the all-encompassing influence of the Zionist movement. I mean, they not only controlled Hollywood, they controlled the press. Here's one where an alternative medium site that many view as a perfectly respectable Op-Ed News was actually controlled by someone who's clearly a Zionist, who wouldn't let me publish articles because they were true about the involvement of Israel in the events of 9/11. I find it really quite shocking, despicable, even obscene.
Well, let's unpack this a little bit more, Jim, the caveat, the idea, because, you know, I think it can be couched within the greater theme of the NSA surveillance and the extent to which we are being infiltrated through media, through social media, through internet use. I mean, what are your thoughts on this? I know you've mentioned before the NSA surveillance, that is like focused on the idea of looking for incidents of domestic terrorism. That's their justification. But in reality, what they're doing is something far different, correct?
No, absolutely right. Yeah. Because, I mean, I've already explained that there is no a domestic terrorist threat to speak of. The FBI and the DHS are fabricating events like Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing to keep us in a state of semi-terror, in the belief that there actually are terrorists among us. But what they're doing is appears to be targeting veterans, constitutionalists, Ron Paul supporters, 9/11 truthers, NRA members, anyone who might have the courage of their convictions to stand up and oppose the takeover of the United States by a fascist police, military, state, spearheaded by the Department of Homeland Security and aided and abetted by NSA. And I tell you, Israel is playing a key role in all of this because many of our local police are being trained in Israel. They're being sent to Israel and instructed in tactics that are completely incompatible with American traditions. The Israelis are treating them how to do with, resistance fighters, as it were, you know, individuals who have to be put down or subjugated by means of force. That's not typical of the United States. It virtually never happens in the United States. So they're being indoctrinated or brainwashed with techniques where they're now being given all this surplus military equipment under the Pentagon Program 1033 that ought to be abolished. In fact, if there's a benefit to derive from Ferguson, it's that a number of prominent politicians, including Claire McCaskill, whom you know, and Rand Paul, are picking up on the idea of reconsidering this policy of providing surplus military equipment to local police. They don't understand it. They don't need it. But when it's around, they have an invariable temptation to want to use it to show they're the big guy on the block, to assume the role of a bully instead of a big brother. And the transition is subtle, but the effects are profound.
Yeah, actually, Jim, we were living in Massachusetts when we first started the show a few years back, and we were just living in this little sleepy, I guess you could say, rich coastal town. We were not of the richer class, but after a while, I had noticed that the local police department, which was steadily growing during the time that we were living there, had also acquired not only new equipment and new vehicles, but also two Humvees that were painted camouflage as if they were military vehicles. And this is a town that probably has less than...
It's like 6,000 year-round residents.
Right. And then, you know, the population would quadruple in the summertime season and all that, which might be their minor justification for pumping up their police force. But the fact of the matter is, most of the things that actually happened in that town had to do with, you know, petty theft, little break-ins every now and then.
Drunk driving did
not require one, let alone two, Humvee militarized vehicles.
And these police officers in this town, Jim, you'd get a kick out of it because I know you've been to urban areas in America. These guys are, first of all, they're usually very out of shape. They've got flak jackets on underneath their uniforms, and they're, you know, paid $90,000 a year to start to patrol this little town that's filled with, you know, summer residents, retirees, and working class folk.
What a ridiculous waste of expenditures. I mean, those salaries for performing that work and then giving them, you know, these glorified military vehicles, how ridiculous can you get?
And that's just one example, right? In thousands and thousands of examples across the country, right?
Yeah, I know. That's exactly right. I mean, all the military forces, all the police forces are being turned into a quasi-military force around the country. And it's part and parcel, it appears to me, of the plan to take control of this country by force. I really have no doubts about it. Homeland Security has acquired over 2 billion rounds of 40 caliber hollow point ammunition. That's not even permissible in combat under the Hague Convention of 1899 because it is designed to maim and kill. Ordinary military ammunition is usually copper jacketed and pointed, so it'll pass through a body and take a combat soldier out of action, but not, you know, rip him apart like those 40 caliber hollow point shells will do. They've acquired a large number of light tanks and a whole lot of assault weapons. They've even made special arrangements with mortuaries and funeral homes that should there be some event take place in the nation, otherwise unspecified, that led to a surplus of casualties beyond what emergency medical facilities and hospitals could handle, that the surplus would be turned over to the funeral homes and the mortuaries. I mean, they're talking about plans for major action involving the slaughter of a lot of Americans on a large scale. It's very, very disturbing.
After Sandy Hook happened, Jim, the day after, when we brought our kids to grammar school that day, there was an armed police officer outside the school. My son asked me, why? Why was that? Why was there a police officer outside of the school? And I said, because they want everybody to feel safe, I guess. But he said, that's weird. I don't understand. He was only 6 or 7 years old.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he actually feels safer if there's a police officer there where there was none before. It creates the impression that there's some threat that he requires a police officer's presence, which wasn't present in the past. So that, you know, I think it has the opposite effect. It's not reassuring. Actually, it's subtly disturbing.
Yes, and this theme that we're going with the militarization of the police and the idea of them not even being properly trained in order to use the equipment they're being given, which creates all kinds of collateral issues. And you know, moving forward from that theme, Jim, I've heard you talk about the idea of the informal police state. And I wondered if you might expound upon what the shift and what would it take, Jim, do you think, in what do you surmise it would take for the shift to go from informal to a formal police state in our time here in America?
Well, I'm sorry to say it might not take much. Apparently, we've been under a state of emergency since 9/11 that Bush declared that's never been relieved. It gives the President of the United States extraordinary powers, complete control over transportation, communication, hospital, all other, you know, sub-areas of the economy and our society with regard to its organization, so that if there were some perceived threat, national threat, he could declare martial law, and it would thereby come to pass. All that stands between the American people and the outcome of a police state, a police military state, a police military fascist state, is 100 million armed Americans. And frankly, since Sandy Hook, with the threat of gun control, millions more have gone out to buy weapons that would never otherwise. I have a friend who's reported seeing a little old lady, you know, in a sporting goods store, buying a weapon, and the clerk was she was looking at a shotgun, and the clerk was saying, maybe you'd like something a little more modest for home defense. And she says, "Don't kid me, Sonny. I'm going to be ready when they come."
Yeah, my own mom, you know, she was a pacifist my whole life. I could never have imagined that just recently, after years of continuous Fox News broadcasting in their bedroom 24/7, just a couple years ago, she said to me that she was considering purchasing a firearm. And I mean, not to say, as we've already covered, you and I both agree that the only thing keeping tyranny at bay in America is the 100 million gun owners. And so it's not to say that I don't support that 100%, but I must remark that I found it fascinating, my mother's new position politically.
Well, Frater, I was very amused that when, you know, you got figures like former Mayor Bloomberg of New York and Barack Obama talking about, you know, how they want to do away with guns and so forth, you see photographs of them anywhere, they're surrounded by bodyguards. So here's a photograph of Bloomberg, and there are about 10 people around him and little arrows pointing to each of them. Gun, 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 gun. Oh, Barack Obama out at an event surrounded by people, arrows pointing to them. Gun, 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 gun. Why do we bother to call the police if we're in harm's way? Because they are armed. If we are ourselves armed, we don't have to wait that delay for the police to show up. We can handle this situation on our own. We need to have citizen soldiers. That was what the Founding Fathers envisioned. Where would we have been at Concord or Lexington if the American patriots had been unarmed? We would have been defeated by the British, and we'd still be a colony of the UK. I mean, it's just stunning. And the very idea that we could be invaded, you know, that the Russians could be coming or the Chinese could be coming, or the UN could be coming. How would we fend ourselves against them if we are an unarmed populace? Some have tested the sincerity of those who propose gun control and asked if they would like to have a sign put in front of their homes that says, "This is a gun-free zone." Would you believe none of them are willing to have a sign on front of their home saying this is a gun-free zone, since it's such an obvious invitation to burglars and rapists and who knows what.
So yeah, it's, again, I'm not surprised. No one wanted to advertise they were undefended.
You know? Well, it's such a stupid idea. You know, who has this colossal stupidity to propose such an idea? I mean, there's a long tradition of the Second Amendment, and it's very clear that one of the principal purposes of the Sandy Hook fraud, the hoax, the deception, the illusion, was to undermine our Second Amendment rights by creating an emotional disturb charge case. I mean, that's why they had innocent children, be slaughtered, even though the weapons had been legally purchased, presumably. although there's no evidence whatsoever, even an ATF agent observed, that they found no indications that Adam Lanza or his mother had gone any shooting ranges or gun clubs or whatsoever. In fact, the whole thing appears to be a farce. This is a fictional character. Someone had a wild imagination when they put the scenario together.
Well, Jim, you mentioned several states outside of America, international countries and the threat therein. And I think that's a good segue because I wanted to talk to you. As you know, I'm a big fan of your podcast. I listen all the time. And I've heard several times you've made the caveat about Vladimir Putin as an international man of peace, especially when you compare him to the United States. And I'd like to hear more about this because I found it remarkable. It gave me pause, being a child of the Cold War, because I can't deny what you're implying, but I'd like for the listeners to get an idea of what you mean by that, Jim.
Well, let's go back to the origins of our involvement in the Middle East. I mean, the most important revelation came from Wesley Clark, who, after his return from serving as Supreme Commander of Allied Forces Europe, which means he was the head of NATO, had an encounter with a general at the Pentagon who told him that there was a plan to attack Iraq, even though Iraq had not been involved in 9/11. Wesley Clark explained all this in a speech to the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco in October of 2007. It was a kind of a, you know, he regarded it as a result of the coup that had been engineered in the White House by Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz on behalf of the plans or of the project for the New American Century, which wanted to seize the what they regarded as the unique historical opportunity with the demise of the Soviet Union in 1990-91, that if the United States would move aggressively into the Middle East, then it could exert military and diplomatic pressure outward from that geopolitically sensitive region and bring about the creation of an American empire worldwide that would endure for the next 100 years. Well, 6 weeks later, Wesley Clark saw the same officer and asked, "Why haven't we attacked Iraq? Are we still going to attack Iraq?" And he said, "Sir, it's worse than that." He said, he pulled a piece of paper off his desk and said, "I just got this memo from the Secretary of Defense's office. It says we're going to attack and destroy the governments of 7 countries in 5 years. We're going to start with Iraq, and then we're going to move into Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran." Clark said the idea was to destabilize the Middle East, turn it upside down, and make it under our control. But of course, that's completely ridiculous. That's not what's happened. These countries have historic animosity between conflicting factions. Look at the case in Iraq. We had Saddam Hussein, who was a secular leader, a strong man who imposed control on a nation that was fraught with divisions among the Sunni, the Shia, and the Kurds. You remove him, as you remove Generalissimo Tito from Yugoslavia, and all the little nations or sections of society become in conflict with one another, so that the plan has been to simply get rid of the secular leaders like Assad in Syria, where, again, he's holding a nation together that would otherwise be rife with conflict. Wesley Clark, during his talk, recounted a conversation he'd had 10 years earlier with Paul Wolfowitz. This was back in 1991, in which the then number 3 Pentagon official was criticizing George Herbert Walker Bush for not taking out Saddam, and who told Clark, "The one thing we did learn from the first Persian Gulf War is that we use our military in the region, in the Middle East, and the Soviets won't stop us. And we got about 5 or 10 years to clean up those old Soviet regimes, Syria, Iran, Iraq, before the next great superpower comes on to challenge us." Clark said he was shocked by Wolfowitz's desires and plans because, as he put it, presumably the purpose of the military is to stop wars, not start wars, or to change governments. Surely it's to defer conflicts. But that's been the master plan behind 9/11, to get the United States engaged in wars in the Middle East, to destabilize the governments that served as a counterbalance to the influence of Israel in the Middle East. They have aspirations to control all of the Middle East from the Tigris, Euphrates, to the Nile. and they're absolutely dedicated to this. This is the Zionist game plan, and although it's a little nation, and the claim has been made that a small nation couldn't control a large one, that ignores the historical parallel with Great Britain, a little nation that had a worldwide empire in the past, the Commonwealth of Nations. And it's really striking that it ignores the vast influence of the Zionists in the United States in controlling the mass media, controlling Hollywood, and through AIPAC, which is the most powerful political action committee the world has ever seen in Washington, D.C. So what we are doing is suffering the ramifications and the consequences, and the instability is simply leading to untold chaos where this ISIS business appears to be a complete fraud and fabrication. The so-called beheadings of the journalists appear to be staged, probably in the same studio in Israel where the little trailer called The Innocence of Muslims was used to create unrest, discontent among followers of Islam in the Middle East. They are well-produced. Their production qualities are high. They have a bad guy from Central Casting who ironically has a British accent. They're produced in English with Arabic subtitles when it should be the opposite. The alleged journalists don't look terrified as though they're about to lose their lives. The use of a knife is really ridiculous. You should be doing this with a sword or an axe if it were for real. And there's essentially no blood involved. I'm telling you, these are staged events. The American people are so gullible that they buy it. The media, you know, talks about beheadings, which haven't taken place. This is all completely fraudulent. It appears to be an imaginary scheme because Bashar Assad has been so successful in mopping up the rebels in Syria, they've had to fall back and design a new plan. I have no doubt that this ISIS has come from the fertile imagination of Bibi Netanyahu, who wants to get the U.S. back into Syria. We have Obama now talking about getting permission from the Congress not only to attack ISIS in Iraq, and also he implies in Syria, but to arm the moderates in Syria. There are no moderates in Syria. And this is just another gross violation of international law. It's another attempt to dupe the American people. The outrage when after the chemical weapons were used in Syria, which was blamed on the Assad government but rebutted by Russian reports that showed it had actually been done by the rebels, had led Obama to propose lobbing cruise missiles into Syria, which would not only have been a violation of international law but bring about the deaths of many more civilians than had the gas attacks themselves. The American people were outraged, and the White House was absolutely besieged with a flood of emails and protests. Something like 90 to 95% of the people were putting their foot down. So this appears to be another gambit, another attempt to market and package an effort to get the U.S. into Syria to follow through on the neocon game plan that Wesley Clark was reminding us of when he spoke at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco in 2007. The beat goes on.
So in light of all this, this is America in the international court versus Putin and Russia. Can we elaborate on them?
Well, here's the thing about Putin. Putin has been very successful in creating this alternative to the entrenched banking establishment, which includes the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund that represent the Rothschilds' banking empire. The Rothschilds have had an interest in creating chaos in the Middle East because usury is frowned upon. Making money off of money is frowned upon in Islam. So they haven't been able to get a foothold in the Muslim nations. I was struck when the first action by the alleged rebel group in Libya was to found a new central bank, which told me all I needed to know about what was going on there. Muammar Gaddafi, by the way, was a benevolent dictator. He shared the wealth of Libya with the Libyan people. He gave $25,000 gifts to newly married couples. He had a system of universal education and health care. He was undertaking one of the great engineering projects of history, the Great Waterworks Project, that would have brought water and turned the North Africa into a fertile oasis. And he was introducing the gold dinar, a very stable form of currency that would have been adopted all over Africa. He had to be stopped, it was on the verge of the United Nations giving him a humanitarian award that he was taken out. It was ruthless, aggressive, using NATO, just as they want to use NATO all over again in a ruthless, aggressive way to take out Bashar Assad in Syria. Putin has been so successful in organizing the BRICS banking alternative, where BRICS stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, that on a visit to South America, the leaders of the South American and Latin American countries were expressing their firm support for BRICS. This is a major threat to the West, and it's heretofore control over the banking around the world. It's very important. It's going to increase stability in the world overwhelmingly. And in fact, it's ironic that Vladimir Putin passed through the Ukrainian airspace only about a half an hour before that Malaysian Flight 17 was shot down. We now have evidence, by the way, from pieces of fuselage that bullets were entering and exiting both sides from both directions of that plane. It appears to have been shot down by the two Ukrainian fighters that were escorting it. Moreover, and this will come as quite a shock to your listeners, it appears to be the same plane that disappeared in Southeast Asia months and months ago, Flight 370. In fact, those first on the scene were reporting that the corpses, the bodies, were in an advanced state of decomposition, which I think resulted from their attempting to preserve them, but not doing a very good job of it. Russia and Vladimir Putin had absolutely nothing to do with it. This was another contrived event. Indeed, Victoria Nuland, an undersecretary of state, has admitted openly the United States invested $5 billion to create unrest in Ukraine. We know Russian weapons were smuggled in to be used against the demonstrators to try it look as though Russian supporters or Russians themselves had been responsible. They chased the democratically elected leader of the Ukraine fleeing for his life. The Obama administration immediately recognized the results of the coup. Subsequently, they've held another election and elected a very much of a stooge who's deferential to the West in lieu of their formerly pro-Russian leader. It's quite grotesque, but the assaults against the Eastern Ukrainians have worked out poorly. If we were getting accurate information, which is coming from other international sources like Russia Today or Press TV, it appears that the Eastern Ukrainians have been routing the forces of Kiev, just as Bashar Assad's forces in Syria have been routing the rebels. Well, the West isn't going to stand for that. That's why we get ISIS, these staged attacks, and Obama seeking support from Congress. It's an outrage. It's a deception. But the American people are so gullible, they're all too likely to fall for it.
So, Jim, you also have mentioned recently in one of your talks on your podcast, a little aside during the conversation that you never came back to, but I thought maybe I'd ask you directly. You mentioned Obama invading, 17 African nations? Is that correct?
Yes. During the Obama administration, we've had American military action in 17 different nations in Africa. I mean, this is a man who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Give me a break. He's been more warlike and aggressive than Bush and Cheney. That speaks volumes about Barack Obama.
So this is all under auspices of, like, peacekeeping police actions or putting down insurrections?
They fabricate an event. You see, it's beautiful. With the demise of the Soviet Union, the military-industrial congressional complex needed a new boogeyman. You no longer had the specter of international communism to motivate taxpayers to tolerate the untold hundreds of billions of dollars expended annually on military weapons and so forth, where military spending, by the way, has a very low multiplier effect. Spending on automobiles, for example, which involves many different industries, a tire industry, the leather industry, upholstery, radios, stereos, and all that, has a very high multiplier effect. Military spending, very low. So they needed a new boogeyman. What could be better than a shadowy terrorist organization that does not even have any geographical boundaries? Anytime you need a terrorist event, you can make one happen. And who can say when you declare it was the act of terrorists that was not the case, because you control the media anyway? And they contrived all this in the events of 9/11, faking hijackers aboard planes, none of which actually crashed, all of which were fabricated or faked in different ways, using a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes to destroy the Twin Towers and then cast it off as a collapse. I mean, it's all been completely outrageous, but the American people have been played for saps. And because of the role of the media here in endlessly reporting the government's official position and what they want us to know has gone right along with it. In fact, one of the most disturbing recent developments has been that the Smith-Mundt Act of 1948, which precluded the use of propaganda by the American government on the American people, has been vitiated by the National Defense Appropriations Act of 2013, so that now the government is able to use all the texts of propaganda on the American people it's used abroad on foreign nations. That speaks volumes again about the integrity and quality of the government we have in Washington, D.C. today.
Well, Jim, you know, you're one of the most, you're the perfect guest, because you always seem to bring us back around to the next segue just in your rhetoric. It's amazing how you do that, because I'll have something down as the next thing I want to talk about, and you'll invariably mention it in your last quote, your last comment, which sets it up like a perfect discursive handball back and forth here, you know. But having said that, you mentioned your main thesis with regards to the events that occurred on 9/11, and I'd just like to take a few moments and let you expound upon that for any listeners to our show that might not be clear on exactly what you propose went is the most probable events that went down on 9/11 as far as what actually happened to those towers, Jim.
Well, 9/11 was contrived by the CIA, the neocons, and the Department of Defense, who'd been supporting the project for the new American century and the Mossad. The properties, the World Trade Center, had historic problems. The two towers were laden with asbestos, and they had tenancy difficulties. So they were really enormous white elephants. The Port Authority had directed that they should be the asbestos should be removed, but it couldn't be done by classic controlled demolitions, because that would have exposed all the asbestos to the atmosphere. And erecting scaffolding around 110-story buildings would have been, you know, prohibitively expensive, run about $1 billion a building. So instead they were used, you know, as symbolic targets of the American economy worldwide. The whole story of 9/11 was fabricated. They were set up using what was described at the time as the largest elevator renovations project in history. To get workers into the elevator shaft to plant these explosives. It appears to have been done using principally mini or micro nukes. While some thermite or nanothermite may have been used, it's virtually non-explosive. So the idea of explosive nanothermite is actually a myth. I published three articles about this with T. Mark Hightower, who's a chemical engineer, where we explain that it's a law of material science that in order for an explosive to destroy a material, it must have a detonation velocity equal to or greater than the speed of sound in that material. The speed of sound in concrete is 3,200 meters per second, in steel 6,200. And the fact is that the highest attributed detonation velocity for nanothermite is only 895 meters per second, which means it can't possibly have even pulverized the concrete, much less decimated the steel. Now, those who defend the nanothermite thesis say, yes, but it could be combined with explosives to do the job. And I say, well, the same is true of toothpaste. Toothpaste also is non-explosive, but you could combine it with explosives. And the question then becomes, what were the explosives with which it was combined that actually did the work that blew the Twin Towers apart? Now, here to understand what's going on, you have to contrast what happened to Building 7, which went down at 5:20 in the afternoon as a classic controlled demolition. You see a little characteristic kink at the top of the building, which is indicative of key support columns being blown so that if the building starts to fall one way or another, it will fall into its own footprint. All the floors are falling at the same time. Takes about 6.5 seconds, approximately the speed of free fall, and when it's over, you have a pile of debris equal to about 12% of the height of the original 47 floors, or about 5.5 floors, typical of what happens with controlled demolitions of towers and stadium and hotels in Las Vegas. We've seen it a lot. It yields about a 12% pile of residue. In the case of the Twin Towers, however, the situation is completely different. The Twin Towers are blowing apart in every direction. Notice Building 7 is not blowing apart in every direction. That requires some additional source of energy that's simply enormous. In fact, it's blowing very weighty chunks of steel outward in a pattern so that when the destruction sequence is complete and all the floors in the Twin Towers are waiting patiently their turn to be blown to kingdom come, in the memorable phrase of Morgan Reynolds, where those 500,000-ton buildings are being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, there is no stack of pancakes. There is no 12% of 110 floors, which would have been 13 and a half or so floors there. It's not there. Those buildings were destroyed to or below ground level in terms of their footprint, which means it was no classic demolition. It was no kind of collapse. In fact, Chuck Baldwin, who is a retired high school physics and chemistry teacher, has explained how, given the design of the towers, it was actually impossible for them to collapse. The steel used in their construction in the core columns was 6 inches thick at the base, then 5'4", tapered off to a quarter inch at the top, which meant that if you looked at the top 14 floors of the North Tower above the level where the plane is alleged to have hit, that represented only 1.4% of the steel in the building. And the idea that that 1.4% of the mass of the steel could overwhelm the lower 98.6 is simply preposterous. As John Skilling, who is a member of the engineering firm that built the, observed, it was designed with a safety factor of 20, which means every floor could support 20 times its expected live load, dead load meaning unoccupied, plus furniture, personnel, you know, equipment, commodes, and all that. So it was simply ridiculous. The Twin Towers could not collapse. And the claim that they did is just ridiculous, another gigantic lie that's been foisted off upon us. In fact, the claim was made that it was the jet fuel that burned so intensely that causes steel to weaken or even melt. But that's ridiculous. As Jesse Ventura, for example, has observed, his camping stove, which is also made of steel, burns propane, which burns at a higher temperature than kerosene, which is a principal ingredient of jet fuel. The phrase jet fuel makes it sound like it's really potent, but actually it's relatively weak. And yet his camping stove doesn't melt when he uses it on a camping trip. The fires in the South Tower only burn for about an hour, in the North about an hour and a half. NIST conducted its own review of 236 samples of steel it selected from the buildings. It found 233 had not been exposed to temperatures above 500 degrees Fahrenheit, the other three not above 1,200. 500 degrees is the temperature of an ordinary office fire. No steel structure high-rise in history has ever collapsed because of fire before 9/11, after 9/11, or on 9/11, it turns out. And Underwriters Laboratory had certified the steel used in the building to 2,000 degrees for 3 or 4 hours without suffering any undue influence. We have a mass of evidence that it was done using a sophisticated arrangement of micro or mini nukes. While the thermite crowd talks about little steel spheres in the dust, they haven't done a very good job of analyzing the dust samples they have, because the U.S. Geological Survey has conducted much more extensive analyses of dust all over New York and has found all kinds of elements that would only be there had this been a nuclear event, including barium and strontium, thorium and uranium, lithium, lanthanum, yttrium, chromium, tritium. I mean, it's completely ridiculous how much evidence there is that this was a nuclear event, and yet there are those who want to deny it. In fact, we have a whole host of victims, first responders and other New Yorkers who've been afflicted with all kinds of unusual harm that are associated with exposure to ionizing radiation, including non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, leukemia, thyroid, pancreatic, brain, prostate, esophageal, and blood and plasma cancers. And while when I conducted the Vancouver hearings in 2012, in Vancouver, British Columbia, we thought then that there were over 1,000 first responders who suffered from these afflictions. Gordon Duff, the senior editor at Veterans Day, has updated the figure, and it's over 70,000 New Yorkers who have suffered these kinds of debilitating effects that appear to be caused by ionizing radiation. Don't forget Christy Whitman, who observed, even though she had to know all that asbestos and all these other hard metals from computers and so forth that were in the building, were in the atmosphere, declared that the air in New York City was fit to breathe. That was a completely obscene action that put all kinds of New Yorkers at risk. And incidentally, and this is very curious, New York undertook an extensive replacement for air conditioners in New York City, which had accumulated this dust. And I don't think they were doing it to benefit the people of New York, but because they wanted to remove those samples from becoming possible subjects of study, since they would have revealed what the U.S. Geological Survey revealed, namely that this had been done as a sophisticated operation using nuclear devices.
Jim, have you looked into any claims of other things happening inside the buildings, the Twin Towers, especially, say, the basement, or of things being taken from the buildings or brought into the buildings, about maybe rumors of the gold being taken from the Twin Towers that was there at the bottom? And just to kind of jump a little off to the side, I don't know if you saw the first X-Files movie, but we did when it came out. And at the time, in the very first 5 minutes of the movie, it starts out in Dealey Plaza, ironically enough, and there is one of the government buildings is being set up in a very, very much like a terrorist bombing situation. They put bodies in there and they loaded the building with explosives, and it exploded, and it became dubbed as a terrorist act and everything like that. And at the time, I was thinking about the Oklahoma City bombings, and maybe this was like art imitating life kind of thing with the Oklahoma City bombing. But then 9/11 happened, and everything else happened from then. And I thought, oh my God, could it have been staged? Could it have actually been done like it had been done in the movie?
Well, roughly the answer is yes. Yeah. I mean, I think this was anticipatory, planting the very idea in the minds of the viewers. Or was this the lone gunman segment? It's been much touted, you know, by commentators on...
No, actually, it was the actual first X-Files movie, not the lone gunman, because I know that's...
That was a TV series, right. Got it. X-Files movie, very interesting. Well, let me... You precipitate a couple of lines of thought for me. One is that there was a member of the New York Emergency Management Authority that entered the Building 7 and headed for the command and control center that Rudy Giuliani had set up there, two floors with its own air and water supply. He found half-eaten sandwiches and still steaming cups of coffee. A fireman came along and said, "We got to get you out of here. There were explosions taking off." This is in the morning of 9/11. He's inside Building 7, which is not going to be destroyed until 5:20 in the afternoon. And it does appear that it was originally supposed to be taken down approximately the same time as Building 1 and 2, but something went wrong. So he's inside the building and he's hearing explosions going off. A stairwell is blown out from under him. At one point, he feels himself stepping over dead bodies. He can't see them in the pitch darkness. When he gets out, he is interviewed multiple times. You can find the interviews online. His name is Barry Jennings. Now, the original 9/11 Commission report didn't even mention Building 7. But when it became such an object of discussion on the internet, they eventually did a separate study. And would you believe, about 2 days before they issued their final report on Building 7, Barry Jennings died mysteriously, where he would have been in the position to contradict what they were saying about Building 7 based upon his own personal experience. I do not regard that as a mere coincidence. As far as other explosions are concerned, yes, there were massive explosions in the sub-basement of both of the Twin Towers that occurred at approximately the same time that the alleged planes were hitting the building. Those were images of planes rather than real planes, and I can go into that in some detail. But the fact of the matter is they got their timing off so that these explosions in the sub-basement took place 14 and 17 seconds before the alleged impacts of the planes, which were supposed to explain the explosions in the sub-basement on the basis of jet fuel falling through the elevator shafts. Now, that's a tough call in the first place, because the main elevators were staggered every 30 floors. You'd have to get off and move over to another set of elevators. There were a couple of service elevators. William Rodriguez, who was the senior custodians in the North Tower, reported the massive explosion that occurred beneath his feet. And how one of his fellow custodians had been trapped in one of the service elevators but emerged unscathed. Other custodians showed up with the skin hanging from their body from the effects of the demolition. It was only when Willie came here to Madison and gave a talk, and he and I and Kevin Barrett were having dinner together, and he started describing watching the basements, the sub-basements fill up with water, that I realized the principal purpose of those explosions was to drain the sprinkler system of water so it couldn't extinguish the very modest fires that remain after the tremendous fireballs from the ignition of previously positioned fuel supply had burned up in those spectacular events that only lasted 10 or 15 seconds, because the very modest fires that remained could have been easily extinguished had the fuel system, the sprinkler system, still been functioning. So since they were going to use these fires as the alleged cause, even though, as I've already explained, it's impossible, the buildings couldn't have collapsed and the fires didn't burn long enough or hot enough to bring about any weakening of the steel, much less causing it to melt. That was how they sought to arrange it in the mind of the public. And why, I have no doubt, when a fire chief got up to the 78th floor of the South Tower and called back and said, "We only got a couple of fires here, give me a couple of lines and we'll put them out," that communication triggered the destruction sequence for the South Tower, because they couldn't afford to have the fires extinguished. They'd lose their rationale for the alleged collapse of the building, which, of course, was no collapse at all, as I've already explained. Now, regarding gold and so forth, yes, 9/11 appears to have been one of the, an occasion for perhaps the greatest gold heist in history, that there were massive supplies of gold in the vaults. They, even after the event, found a truck that had been was going to be used to move them that had somehow become stalled or stopped. And that Building 6 was a customs house with all kinds of valuable contents, which were depleted in this event. So you across the board, Mater, you're right on all counts.
Thanks, Jim. I just kind of like to point out here that obviously something happened on 9/11, something that certain people don't want us to know about. That is something that we have, that's very, very, very different than what we've been told. And I personally would really like to know who and why. Because obviously the buildings didn't come down because of a couple planes hitting them. I mean, I never bought that. Even the moment it happened, it just didn't seem right to me. And when it happened, we were living in Portland, Oregon, actually. And I'll tell you, both the Freighter X and I noticed an immediate police presence in the city streets immediately after the first and second planes hit.
Isn't that remarkable? Was just crazy. Isn't that remarkable? Why would the police think they should be out in the streets because of events going on in New York City and you're residing in Portland, Oregon?
Oh, exactly. Jim, it's even further than that. Because if you remember the climate politically, politically up until that time, we had had the riot in Seattle, WTO, which was connected to the World Trade Center, you know, obviously. And there was the streets of Portland were on fire. Every other day, it seemed like they were having demonstrations where they were having to shut down the downtown area and people were marching with picket signs and demonstrating. There was an area called Patriot Square, which was, or Pioneer Square, which was right downtown, that I used to walk by it every day when I got off the bus. And it would be filled with people, young people, college people, protesters, signs, all kinds of stuff. But when I came out the door that morning of 9/11 and I went to work that morning, especially we lived in the what was called the ghetto, the northeast side of Portland, right on the corner of MLK Boulevard and Killingsworth Avenue. And that's where our apartment was. And when we'd come out the door, it's the urban area. Well, that morning when I came out, I walked up the street and there was National Guardsmen on the corner. National Guardsmen with these are military vehicles that were like, No, I don't think they were camel. I think they were just green, you know, military issue green, like National Guard, you know. And then every major intersection on the bus on the way into the city, there was National Guards and police. And I'm thinking to myself, what's going on? And I mean, I knew what had happened in New York, but I was still stunned by it. I had to go to work. So then I come downtown, I get off the bus, I walk by Pioneer Square, and it is virtually empty. I mean, empty. There's nobody there except for one man standing in the very center with a sign that says, "They did it." I had no idea what that meant at the time, you know, but I went to work. And I mean, that's just my remarkable story about that morning. And so, but like you pointed out at the beginning of your breakdown of your theory, you propose, and I must readily agree with you, that it was once again a concerted effort of the military industrial corporate, you know, complex that you speak of.
Well, bear in mind, you know, I'm the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and I have had the benefit of bringing together expertise from pilots, physicists, engineers, structural, aeronautical, mechanical, civil, as well as many other students of 9/11. So none of this is, am I making up out of whole cloth. I've had the benefit of extensive collaborative efforts, and you know, a website you did not mention is 911scholars.org, 911scholars.org, where you can find quite a repository of articles, interviews, essays, a whole lot of good stuff about 9/11 for those who are unfamiliar. I want to hasten to add, by the way, that in case we don't get into the faking of the crash sites, which means that no passengers aboard any of those planes actually died in crashes that did not take place, which means that there were no suicide hijackers aboard those planes that caused them to crash, which means that the whole war on terror is predicated on a false proposition, a piece of fakery. I mean, David Ray Griffin, in his magisterial work, the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, observes as his very first point that a half a dozen of these alleged suicide hijackers had turned up alive and well the following day, even including Mohammed Atta's father reporting a phone call from his son, whose passport miraculously survived the destruction of the Twin Towers and was found on a street in New York City. I mean, how can suicide hijackers have survived their own suicide? It means that none of those planes were actually crashing. They were all fabricated or faked, albeit in different ways. And for some reviews of the evidence of this, I recommend going to an early article of mine about this entitled Planes, No planes, and Video Fakery. And for a more recent presentation, go to the Midwest 9/11 Truth Conference Part 2, where I not only explain how nanothermite cannot have blown the buildings apart and how it was done using a sophisticated arrangement of micro or mini nukes, but I go through the evidence on the ground that no plane crashed in Shanksville, no plane hit the Pentagon, and that what we saw were the images of planes that hit the buildings in New York City, not real planes, because they were performing feats that no real planes could perform.
Good point. Good point. I've actually wondered that myself. Matter of fact, years ago, I came across this old issue of Fate magazine from, I think from the 60s or 70s, and I haven't been able to find it since then, but it was talking about this mass hallucination or something that happened on the coast of Havana Beach in Cuba in 1962 or 3, in which several people actually witnessed the image of, I believe, the Virgin Guadalupe projected over the water as a hologram. But nobody, of course, knew at the time. The people who were seeing it didn't really think of it as a hologram. They thought it was actually an image of the Virgin Guadalupe. But then I came across some information about there having been a program in the American military about holographic images and projecting them to people to create hysteria or something like that. And I was wondering if you'd heard anything about any of the people, the non-hijacker people that were on the planes. What happened? Did any of them kind of come up alive later on?
Well, one especially striking instance involves a purported passenger aboard Flight 77, which is supposed to have hit the Pentagon. Ted Olson, who was at the time the Solicitor General for the United States, which means he represented the government in cases between before the Supreme Court, claimed he'd received two phone calls from his wife Barbara, who is a very popular political commentator, right-wing type, from the plane. But he gave three different versions of his report. Initially, he said it was a cell phone call. When it was pointed out that cell phones wouldn't work at those speeds and altitudes, he said it was an airphone call. It turns out that Boeing didn't have any airphones on Boeing 757s at that point in time. Not only that, but the FBI would eventually confirm that there was no through call between Barbara Olson and Ted. He claimed that she was telling him the terrorist had had all the passengers, you know, collected at the back, and what should she do? Can you imagine anything more unbelievable than that? She's aboard the plane that supposedly has been commandeered by terrorists, and she's calling her husband on the ground as to what she should do? I mean, even if she could reach him, the time he had given her any information presumably would be too late to do anything about it. I'm reminded of the whole fakery surrounding the hijackers when C-SPAN covered the American Scholars Conference held in June of 2006 in Los Angeles. During a 140-hour and 45-minute panel discussion, there were four members of scholars on the panel, and then it was hosted by Alex Jones. Stephen Jones, who is a physicist from BYU, whom I invited to be my co-chairman, spoke first. Then Bob Bauman, who'd been a Korean War ace with 101 kills, but who more significantly had a PhD in nuclear engineering from Caltech, and who'd been the director of the Star Wars project under Presidents Reagan and Ford. Webster Tarpley, who is an expert on covert activities by our government and published the book 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in the USA, and myself as the founder of Scholars. And when I had my opportunity, I gave my top 10 list that the hijackers were fake. You can still find it online, where I just went through point after point after point that showed this whole thing involving these hijackers was completely fraudulent and fabricated. So, you know, there's actually been a tremendous amount of evidence that all this was staged from the beginning. But Barbara Olson apparently went to Europe. There were reports that she'd been apprehended in some problem involving financial transactions at the border of two European nations. And there are a number who believe that she underwent cosmetic surgery and returned under the name of Lady Booth and remarried her husband, Ted. So that if you check out Ted Olson and Lady Booth, many of us are inclined to believe that that's actually Barbara Olson in a new guise after plastic surgery.
That's crazy. You know, and another thing, after one of those, the propaganda piece we got about the whole let's roll, that little quote, that little slogan, right? That was the hero of the flight that supposedly wrestled control. He said, let's roll to the other passengers when he ran after him, right? And then after that happened, I remember the computer generated army commercials, the recruitment commercials. If you look closely at those commercials on the bullet casings that they chamber the rounds for the commercial, it says let's roll on the bullets.
I love it. Listen, A.K. Dudney, who is a professor of computer science from Western Ontario, and David Ray Griffin have established that all those phone calls were fabricated or faked. Elias Davidson has observed and explained that the government's never produced evidence that any of the hijackers were aboard any of the planes. Colonel George Nelson has observed that those four aircraft had millions of uniquely identifiable component parts, of which the government has yet to produce even one. Others have observed that for the first time in its history, the National Transportation Safety Board did not investigate plane crashes. All four of those plane crashes, none of them were investigated by the NTSB. When an FBI official was asked why they hadn't investigated, he said it wasn't necessary because we saw them on television. But we didn't see what happened in Shanksville on television. We didn't see what happened in the Pentagon on television. In fact, while the Pentagon would eventually release five frames, surreptitiously initially with the wrong dates and times, four of them are the growing fireball. One is conveniently labeled plane. And if you look at the size of the plane, it's much too small to be a Boeing 757. In fact, I had Jack White,
who was a legendary photo and film analyst, do a comparison of by sizing the image of a Boeing 757 to the image in the plane, and it's much too large. The 757 is more than twice the size of the image in the plane. It's also exuding a white plume, which cannot be from jet exhaust, but is from appears to be from a solid propellant as the plane is about to fire a missile into the building. In fact, we now believe it was a Global Hawk rather than an unmanned aerial vehicle, rather than any plane at all. There's a very fine discussion of top 10 9/11 cons. Fraud vitiates everything online. I encourage everyone to pursue it, because if you have any doubts about the full range of deceptions we've been exposed to, this gives you a nice sampler of 10 really powerful proofs that we've been sold a bill of goods about 9/11. Top 10 9/11 cons. Fraud vitiates everything.
Wow. Jim, I think that's a great preview of what people can expect if they go over to assassinationscience.com, assassinationresearch.com, the Radio Fetzer over at, it's called The Real Deal with Jim Fetzer over at radiofetzer.blogspot.com. And before we end this amazing conversation, once again, you always deliver, Professor Fetzer. We so appreciate you coming. I wanted to just kind of get a little bit personal. I wanted to ask you personally, Professor Fetzer, what gives you hope after we've unpacked all this stuff? What keeps you rising to greet the day each morning, knowing the things that we have talked about today?
Well, as a professional philosopher, I care about truth. And as a philosopher of science, I know that science is our most reliable way to discover the truth. And as a former Marine Corps officer, I care about the future of my country. We can't do anything to deal with these problems until we understand what actually happened on 9/11. I'm committed to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth about 9/11. And I'm going to do everything I can, as long as I can, to bring that truth to the American people. I have great confidence that if the people understand what happened, they will take appropriate action. I believe in America. I believe in the American people. All they need is assistance in sorting out what has actually happened in this series of unbelievable events, including not only 9/11, but also Sandy Hook, but also the Boston bombing, and now with all the calamities going on in the Middle East, including in Ukraine and with ISIS, it's all a massive fraud and deception. The American people have to understand their own government lies to us all the time.
Jim, that's just great on all points. We so appreciate you spending your time with us this last hour and 45 minutes. It's been yet another amazing ride with you. You never fail to bring the clarity that you have uncovered, the information that you have gathered, and the clarity it has given you. We so appreciate you sharing that with the rest of us.
One last point, absolutely, if I might.
Absolutely, sir.
Which is this, to get my articles, I've got about 80 to 100 articles on JFK, 9/11, Fukushima, a host of other events, Sandy Hook, on Veterans Today. You should be able to access those articles, the whole archive, if you go to veteranstoday.com/author/Fetzer/. So you want to go to veteranstoday.com/author/Fetzer to gain access to my articles and just start working backwards to everything you might want to know about regarding any of these important events that have so powerfully affected our lives.
Add this to your favorites, ladies and gentlemen. You won't be disappointed, and you'll learn so many things. Thank you again, Professor Fetzer, for joining us today in the middle chamber. Are there any upcoming events you want to mention before you go, or any appearances that people could look forward to?
Not at present, but I want to thank you, Freighter, and Mater, and your cat for the opportunity to be on your show once again.
It's always a pleasure.
You are so welcome anytime, and we hope to we'll be listening to your podcast, and we'll be probably looking forward to inviting you to come back on and give us an update.
You got it.
All right, excellent, sir. Thank you, and have a great day. And, well, everyone, that's our show, and we want to thank you for stopping by and keep coming back to the middle chamber. Say goodnight, Mater X.
Good night, Mater X.
All right, everybody. Have a great one.